Take me riding in the car, car, take me riding in the car, car. Take you riding in my car, car, I'll take you riding in my car.
This is Our American Stories, and we love to bring you the newest and best music in America. Actually, that's Woody Guthrie doing, I don't know what he's doing there, Jesse. What is he doing with his mouth?
It's called the car song. I don't know, he's making some sound effects.
It kind of reminds me of modern art. It's like, if I can make it, it's not art.
Exactly right. Well, that is definitely not art. And that brings us to our new and latest inaugural feature called Give Me the Keys. We love cars.
Give me the keys.
And so we're going to start it off. And by the way, that comes from Weird Science. And for some reason, half the crew here is just enamored of that movie. I'm going to have to go and take a look because that clip alone makes me want to just see just what's under the hood. And this is Give Me the Keys, and it's where we talk to folks about their cars. Their first cars, their favorite cars. Hey, their worst cars, even their wackiest cars. Mine was a Plymouth Duster, a 1976 yellow Plymouth Duster. It didn't work well for me, and I couldn't wait to get rid of it. If you have a great story about your car you're passionate about or hate, call us at 844-627-8255 and record your story there. Or leave your information there, and we can help you record it. Once again, that's 844-627-8255. For our inaugural feature, we're going to hear a story that comes to us from Wall Street Journal's regular column, My Ride. It was a guy named Jim Gollum that wrote it, and he grew up in a General Motors family and now has a passion for cars that aren't so, well, general. Here's Jim sharing with us his story that gives the term off-roading a whole new meaning.
Here comes a dark cloud on the horizon for anyone who runs a toll bridge for a living. The Amphi car, a new imported model, which is just about at home in the water as it is on the highway.
Well, I grew up in a car family, and I always felt that life was more interesting when you drive fun cars. And the Amphi car is a really fun car. I don't know if you know much about Amphi cars, but they were built in West Germany between 1961 and 1968. They made about 3,878 of them. Of which about 3,000 were imported to the U.S.
The same power plant and the same controls make it a cinch to operate, and twin props send it through the water at a brisk clip.
They were kind of expensive at the time. They only cost around $3,000, but that was only a couple hundred dollars less than a Corvette. But their sales pitch really was that you were buying both a car and a boat.
Tired of crowded highways, Sunday drivers got you down? Well, here's your prescription from a German specialist who says he has come up with a cure. It's the Amphi car, an amphibious automobile that is equally at home on the road or at sea. It certainly opens up new possibilities. Imagine coming to a toll bridge in this car. Just a slight detour and no fee. The inventor claims the car will do better than 100 miles an hour on the highway. But if you find you can't even crawl ahead, you can take to a nearby stream and do 12 miles an hour. Auto ahoy!
They called it a Model 770 since it was supposed to go 7 knots per hour in the water and 70 miles an hour on land. But I think that was really some marketing hype because I think it was more of a 550. You don't get that 7 knots an hour on the water. It really goes about 5 knots per hour in the water and 50 miles an hour on land. The engine only has 43 horsepower, so it's not a speed demon by any means. The real problem with the whole car was that it wasn't a very good car or a very good boat, so it actually made Time Magazine's list of the 50 worst cars ever produced. One of the most famous people to ever own an Amphi car was President Lyndon Johnson, and he had one of them down on his ranch in Texas, and the story goes that he'd give visiting diplomats and friends a ride around the ranch. Then while he was heading home, he'd hit for the pond yelling, "The brakes won't work, we're going under." And he'd roar with laughter as they'd drive into the water, and fortunately they didn't sink. So I saw my first Amphi car off of Chicago's Navy Pier in Lake Michigan and thought, now that has to be fun. In 2009, I found one on eBay. The engine was froze, the transmission was all gummed up, and there were really big rust holes in the quarter panels, which was typical for an Amphi car. Fortunately, nothing that money and time couldn't fix. I found a guy who specialized in restoring Amphi cars, and it took him 18 months to restore my car. And it's been on the road since 2011. It's always interesting when you show the car, people see it, they always want to know, well, how does it work? Well, actually, it's kind of simple. When you want to go swimming, as we call it, You make sure the bilge plug is in. You double latch the doors with a special locking lever that seals the doors. You engage the propellers and drive in. Once you're in the water, you take the car out of gear, and the propellers do the work. You actually steer by turning the front wheel, so the turning radius is pretty horrible. Sometimes when you're coming in a little too fast, you have this natural tendency to want to hit the brakes to slow down. Unfortunately, the brakes don't work in the water. When you go swimming in an amphi car, people can't believe what they're seeing, car in the water. A couple of members of our club actually had the experience where they drove down a car ramp into the lake. A few minutes later, the police show up because someone had called on their cell phone saying, "Oh my God, somebody drove their car in the water." They just kept on swimming and kept waving to the officers as they went by. I have a lot of fun at car shows when you see these kids walking down the aisle and they're looking at their cell phone or playing their video games, totally interested in the cars. And I say, "Hey guys, you know, this is the only car here with propellers." Sort of look at me and say, "Propellers?" I tell them, "Go around the back of the car and take a look." Well, they're just amazed. They start yelling, "Mom, Dad, come here, take a look at this. This car is the coolest car I've ever seen." But they don't know that this is probably one of only 400 cars left in the world, so it's actually something unique and kind of rare. It's an attraction, to say the least. I enjoy telling people the amphi car story and sharing it with people, so that's it.
Well, thanks for that, Jim. And a bad boat and a bad car. And 43 horsepower. Sounds like a gem. But this is the thing about this segment. He loves that car, boat, whatever it is. And we go out where we started with Woody Guthrie making sounds with his face. And you can catch all we do here at Our American Stories. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. And again, call 844-627-8255. Worst car, best car, weirdest car. And by the way, try making this sound with your face if you can. More after these messages.
Take you riding in my car. Climb rattle on the front seat. Spree ice rattle on the back seat. Turn my key, step on the starter, take you riding in my car. Engine, it goes, engine, it goes, front seat, back seat, boys and girls, take you riding in my car. Trees in the houses, walk along, trees in the houses, walk along, truck in a cart in a garbage can, I'll take you riding in my car. Ships and little boats chug along, ships and little boats chug along.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And on this day in history, we landed on the moon. Man walked on the moon. And we did a story about one of those men, and we wanted to bring it back to you. And that man, well, we're not going to name him. We're just going to play this segment that we had actually played on the day he was born. But it's time to repurpose that, because my goodness, there couldn't be a better day to take a listen to this story about the man whose name you know, but who's remarkable past and present, you don't.
Some people call me the space cowboy. Yeah. Some call me the gangster of love. Some people call me Maurice. Cause I speak of the pompousness of love.
Fighter pilot. War hero. Son, MIT rocket scientist, father. He has been all these things and a lot more things, but he's mostly remembered for one thing, something he's a little tired of being asked about. After 60 years of it, you might have been too. He's also tired of it because it's not enough to him. "It's something we did," he says. "Now, we should do something else." His name is Buzz Aldrin.
Buzz Aldrin.
And that something he did, that one thing, was being the second man to ever walk on the moon, answering his president's call of duty.
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
You'd think his vanity license plate would be Moon Guy, yet it's Mars Guy. It's that something else he thinks we should do. Mars. Born in Montclair, New Jersey, Buzz Aldrin's mother had the maiden name Moon. Coincidence, you ask? I don't think so. His real name is Edwin, but his sister couldn't say brother. The name Buzzer just kept coming out of her mouth, and the nickname Buzz sticked. His country is glad it did, and Edwin walking on the moon is not nearly as profound as a Buzz doing so. Buzz was a Boy Scout, as so many great men are. He was also shaped by his family, in good ways and in bad.
Check ignition and may God's love be with you.
His grandfather put a bullet through his brain. His mom swallowed pills to her death. His father was almost too alive in his life. A career military man, his father knew Amelia Earhart, one of the Wright brothers, and took a transatlantic flight on the Hindenburg before it blew up. He wanted his only boy, Buzz, to be just like him, brave and brilliant. But Buzz was shy and sensitive. And he drove himself to his father's dreams for him. When he flew combat missions in the Korean War and was decorated with the Distinguished Flying Cross, his father said, "End?" And so he went to MIT and earned a doctorate of science in astronautics. These elite experiences led him to NASA, and when he walked on the moon, his dad said, "And?" The second man to walk on the moon? Number two? His father was so affected by it that he waged a one-man campaign to get the Postal Service to change its Neil Armstrong First Man on the Moon commemorative stamp to one that said First Men on the Moon, so it could include Buzz. He would lose. And Buzz would lose something much greater when he returned home. As GQ magazine put it, he discovered the melancholy of all things done. He was a conqueror with nothing left to conquer but his own demons. NASA had no more use for Buzz. They sent him around the world like a PR flack. Even though he was a scientist, his mind was left idle. Buzz resigned and returned to the Air Force, but they didn't exactly know what to do with an academic who had just been to the moon. And so Buzz picked up the bottle. He put down his marriage to the mother of his three children. He retired and went into rehab. Tried out marriage again for a year and drank some more. A Cadillac dealership sounded like a good place to go, but he didn't sell very many of them. As if it could get any worse, he created this song with Snoop Dogg.
Are you ready to put on your spacesuit? Strap in for the G-Force liftoff. Countdown is getting very close now to the adventure of a lifetime.
If his life tells us anything, it's that we are complex human beings, all with our own crosses, all capable of our own triumphs, all with a need for love in our lives, especially the love of a father and a mother. To close our tribute to Buzz Aldrin, an American great, born on this day in history in 1930, we take you to his telling of his time on the moon. First with seeing his friend Neil Armstrong becoming the first man to ever set foot on the moon.
It was absolutely correct that the captain, the commander, make the first descent and walk on the moon.
Here men from the planet Earth first set foot upon the moon, July 1969.
We came in peace for all mankind. That statement really, to me, was a very symbolic one of not just our mission, but all of the Apollo effort.
They've got the flag up now, and you can see the stars and stripes on the lunar.
Beautiful, just beautiful.
If you look real close, you can see that I'm saluting the flag. And for a military person, that was indeed a very, very proud moment to be on the moon saluting the flag.
And then Buzz did something a little more reflective. He radioed over to NASA.
This is the LM pilot. I'd like to take this opportunity to ask every person listening in, whoever and wherever they may be, to pause for a moment and contemplate the events of the past few hours and to give thanks in his or her own way.
Ending his radio communication, he then read from the Gospel of John, chapter 15, verse 5, which says,
I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever remains in me and I in him will bear much fruit, for you can do nothing without me.
Buzz said of this verse, I read the words which I had chosen to indicate our trust that as man probes into space, we are in fact acting in Christ. I sensed especially strongly my unity with our church back home and with the church everywhere, and then took communion. Later recounting in Guidepost magazine, I ate the tiny host and swallowed the wine. I gave thanks for the intelligence and spirit that had brought two young pilots to the Sea of Tranquility. It was interesting for me to think, the very first liquid ever poured on the moon and the very first food eaten there were the communion elements. Buzz Aldrin marked his territory in his own special way, and marked what he saw as God's territory in his special way. Although NASA wouldn't let him share with the world what he had done. But in the end, who's going to stop Buzz Aldrin? At least for as long as he continues to wear jockey underwear. Jockey, supporting greatness.
And there you have it, folks, celebrating America's mission to outer space. We're celebrating it here on Our American Stories, the life of Buzz Aldrin, the Rocket Man. And what a story it was, and what a day it was in American history. I remember it like nothing else, huddled around the TV with my family, with my friends, and we just went crazy. We went crazy, and so did the country. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And to hear all of this, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. That's OurAmericanNetwork.org. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And every once in a while, we like to dive into a period of history and talk about whether historians get it right or whether what we learn in school is right. And that period is the Great Depression and the 1920s. Joining us to talk about that is Amity Schles, who teaches at King's College and has written two New York Times bestsellers about this period, A Biography of Calvin Coolidge and the bestseller Forgotten Man. Amity, historians often write books prompted by curiosity. They stumble on a question which doesn't have a good answer to them or doesn't exist in the prevailing literature, so they spend weeks, months, years trying to reconcile that. You were in Berlin researching your bestseller, The Forgotten Man. What hooked you? When did you know that you had to write a reexamination of the Great Depression?
It was working at the Wall Street Journal that I became interested in the Depression, because when you work on Wall Street, you hear about the SEC or the NLRB alphabet institutions, and you run into them as well. For example, at the Journal, we had to write a news story when one company bought 5% of another company's stock. Nobody really explained why we had to do that. When I went back and looked, I saw that it was institutional. The institutions that shaped American business were created in Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. So was that a good thing, the New Deal, or a bad thing? I was very curious, and what rebellion is a great motivator, Lee. And when I went to see editors and say, I'd like to write about the Great Depression, they'd say, you can't. John Kenneth Galbraith decided it with his argument that there was a bubble and then everything was slightly better, saved by Roosevelt. Or Milton Friedman wrote about that with Anna Schwartz, and he decided, heck, it was all monetary. Or a third reply, when I said, I want to write about the Great Depression, you can't because I, the counterparty, the other person, have not made up my mind yet what happened. How right. dare you go there? And, of course, that's like catnip, right? When someone tells you you can't go somewhere. So anyway, I became curious at the Wall Street Journal, which is created by the New Deal. What was the New Deal? And then in Berlin, of course, you know, one could add, what bad happened here? So much bad happened in Berlin. And what good? And what good that happened in Germany since World War II is mostly capitalism. And what bad that happened in Germany? Well, that would be the failure of the communism of East Germany.
Yeah, no doubt. And so here you are. What sources, Amity, does one turn to when the story hasn't been told?
Well, interesting. Around the time I started The Forgotten Man, the PDF came online in a searchable format. We had PDFs before, but searchability was so limited. And one could search the entire New York Times. In the olden days, we used to go to the library, and you remember that, and get out the microfiche, these rolls, and they would be strange colors, and we'd print one page, and it would be scarcely legible, and we'd print two pages that were not legible, and then we put them all in a folder and pat ourselves on the back and say, I did research, and get coffee.
Right. Yep.
I did research, and get coffee. And that is not what I was working with when I started Forgotten Man. I could search the New York Times very fast. If I wanted to look up Lee Habib, I could look it up in about 30 seconds, your name. So that changed the way I wrote the book. It made the book much denser. I thought, let's follow the Depression from day to day. And I really read the papers from about 1930 to about 1940 in the process of researching the book. I got to be a little bit of an addict, 1 a.m. and I'm reading the New York Times. What it said in 1934 about the Supreme Court's gold standard decision, the gold clause decision. But history is addictive.
It is. And, you know, I almost want to, as a sidebar here, I want to say that, you know, the gold standard and the Federal Reserve, Amity, at a time and point, that's almost a five-part series by itself. And I'm sure that the listeners here listening are going, gold standard? Ugh. Federal Reserve, you're putting me to sleep, Habib. But no, these stories are as compelling as when, well, you just heard folks who listened on July 4th, David McCulloch, bringing us a biography of a year. And that's what 1776 was. It was the biography of a year in this country's life. So history can be interesting if it's in the hands of the proper storyteller. And that's what we try and do here in Our American Stories. Amity, people know your writing, and they know your bestsellers. Well, some of the audience might not. But they also don't know and can't know, more than likely, that you teach. And when you meet a bright young college student, what is the textbook understanding of the Great Depression they've encountered in high school and through the media? And is this monolithic, Amity?
Well, I currently teach at the King's College, which is a Christian college, and the knowledge of high schoolers there who come to King's is pretty good. It's an educated student body, thanks to an excellent president, Greg Thornberry. But the general knowledge of all American kids of history, particularly economic history, is deplorable and worse than it was 10 years ago, and that was worse than the decade before. So you can't expect kids to know much. When you study for an AP test, you study so fast that retention is low. That's how they know history. They study fast. So Calvin Coolidge, what's he? He's a little seat warmer between Roosevelt's.
Right.
That's what they learn about the 30th president.
Yep. And but what is the, in the end, what's the, do you think the common understanding is? If you're going to ask somebody what happened in the Great Depression and what was the problem, what would those answers be?
Well, if you asked a regular person, you'd hear the capitalism failed us and President Roosevelt came and rescued us.
Yeah, and that was pretty much the Ken Burns documentary, in essence,
That's
wasn't it?
That's right. The Ken Burns documentary, in fact, ennobles the Roosevelts, T.R. and then Eleanor F.D.R., in a disconcerting way. It's a great documentary, but it does ennoble. It makes them like royalty, like Princess Di. What's that about? They were just presidents, presiders. So if you want to edit the common understanding and give a slightly broader version, you'll hear someone say in a loud voice, Roosevelt came, he worked on the economy, low voice, he didn't do very well fixing the economy. But then came the war, and we were glad he was president, and we won the war, and we love him.
Yep. some documentary that would be.
So there's high voice and low voice. Yep. It's sort of a footnote or a side. But he didn't do very well on the economy. That's how I heard it, in kind of a whisper.
Yep.
And war often trumps economics. So you can see why, if you like Roosevelt in World War II, it's hard to dislike him for his poor economics in the 1930s. You'd rather just forget those poor economics.
You bet. And so to revisit in so much of your work, Amity and the Forgotten Man and Coolidge in particular, first, we have to study what led up to this Great Depression. What was going on in America in the 1920s?
The 1920s were a great decade. Again, in high school, how do we teach the 20s? Mostly champagne bubble with a little prohibition. So it's Gatsby, Boardwalk Empire, plus what else? Maybe a little bit of energy. People know that the automobile, Henry Ford, came out of that period. That was when we saw the benefits of the productivity of the assembly line.
Yep.
They know that. But mostly, it was all false. The bubble popped. And this is rather false. Did you know that F. Scott Fitzgerald's book appeared in the mid-20s, not in 1930?
No, I did not know that.
Yeah, kids think it's describing the Great Crash of 1929. It's describing the crash of 2021, which, by the way, no one remembers. So it was severe because the economy recovered so fast. So even F. Scott Fitzgerald wasn't really positioning his book to undermine the 20s. That's just how the book is positioned in our English classes. So that's what they know. And when one goes back, one finds, well, they were wrong. The 20s were great. By what data points? Well, we like unemployment. Unemployment was usually below 5%. That's pretty good. We like economic growth. They had real economic growth of 4% often. Today that number is an aspirational number.
Yep.
So those two things. But I like to look at patents, and they were through the roof. Patents are little symbols of hope.
Oh,
and
you bet.
Boy, people patented like crazy because they thought they could make money off their idea. That was the environment of normalcy that first Warren Harding offered and then Coolidge.
And how about that, folks? 4% growth, a norm, and patents, as Amity called them, symbols of hope everywhere. And when we come back, more with Amity Schles, more on the Great Depression and the 1920s. Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're covering the Great Depression and the 1920s. And what you learned in school, well, you didn't get the full story, you only got part of it. And here to correct the record, and we like to go back into history and do that, is Amity Schles. She teaches at King's College, and she's written two books about this period that are New York Times bestsellers, The Forgotten Man, which you must read, and the biography of Calvin Coolidge. I wanted to play a clip for you, and this is Calvin Coolidge speaking from the White House in 1924, Amity.
I want the people of America to be able to work less for the government and more for themselves. I want them to have the rewards of their own industry. This is the chief meaning of freedom. Until we can reestablish a condition under which the earnings of the people can be kept by the people, we are bound to suffer a very severe and distinct curtailment of our liberty.
Now, this guy is the, as you said, the placeholder between the Roosevelts. Tell us more about this man, because let me tell you, you flash forward that little snippet into today's environment, and this sounds as relevant a radio clip that I've played on this show. Tell us more about Coolidge. How did he grow up? What shaped his values? And how did he become the president of the United States? Talk about Coolidge.
Coolidge isn't just a good president. He's a great president. And it's a shame for us and a sadness that we don't know about him. He was governor of Massachusetts. He's a New Englander born in Vermont. We at the Coolidge Foundation, where I work, we're in Vermont. Politician in Massachusetts, and then moved to Washington as vice president, and of course then president with the sad passing of President Warren Harding in 1923. What about the policies? As you can hear from the audio, Coolidge was a serious tax cutter.
Yep.
He was like Ronald Reagan. In fact, Coolidge's top marginal rate, which is the thing we look at so often, top marginal rate, that he got taxes down to, his top marginal rate was 25%, which is 3 percentage points lower than the 28% that Ronald Reagan achieved.
And he also used the veto power, didn't he, Amity?
He used the veto power. We tend to think, oh, it was all easy for them. They had no entitlements in the 20s. But there was a very strong progressive impulse in the United States. People thought progressivism was the future. The progressives were within Coolidge's own party, the GOP. So what's he going to do? Coolidge vetoed 50 times, even when he knew that he would be overridden. He was often overridden. So that shows some guts. Particularly, Coolidge comes from a village that's a farming village. They produce cheese in Plymouth Notch, Vermont. What's cheese? It's an exercise in economic desperation. When you have no refrigeration and no train, you have to be sure your milk protein is not perishable. So he knew well how hard it was for farmers, and it was expected, therefore, by the farming lobby that he would sign off on any farm subsidy, but he did veto farm subsidy because he felt the country had to do that.
And so in the end, a principled guy, talk about some of the principles that governed him, or moreover, his philosophy as it relates to work, to human service, and to obligations that folks who have more than others have in the bigger context. Talk about those things.
Coolidge always thought that you should leave room for what he called things of the spirit, for God. So he had a humility, first of all. He said, men do not make laws, they do but discover them. Oh, we don't write the laws, what? That's in contradistinction to the progressives of his day and their positivist attitude.
Yep.
In addition, he had a great civility. It's hard to find him saying a nasty word about his opponent. And he made a point in his autobiography, and I believe in other writings, the point was, every time you mention your opponent's name, you advertise him, and that might not help your campaign. Interesting, right? He found it was better, that is, more politically productive, more successful, to talk about the ideas of his party. So humility, civility, restrained government, and federalism. We must mention federalism. Coolidge pronounced the United States in plural. That's because he remembered there were states. United States are, he sometimes spoke of Washington as the national government because he thought it was confusing when we said the federal government. He wanted to keep federal, that concept of federalism, pure and not linguistically, you know, confusing. Very thoughtful constitutionalist, Coolidge.
Indeed. And anyone who would say the word are is taking federalism really seriously. I mean, that's a great point. He's also known not just for his desire to keep tax rates down, Amity, but to keep budgets down. I mean, if we cut taxes but we increase budgets, this is not exactly good governance. And he also, you quote him once saying, it is much more important to kill bad bills than to pass good ones. Talk about that.
It is much more important to kill bad bills than to pass good ones. Coolidge wrote that to his father, who was a lawmaker in Montpelier, Vermont, as a son's advice to dad. Very interesting, but that informed his sensibility, whether he was mayor of Northampton, Massachusetts, or president of the United States. Let's do less. Do less. What were Coolidge's economics? In modern times, we thought, budgets versus tax rates, and we talk about that all the time. Coolidge believed in lower taxes, not only to reduce government, but also on a moral basis, that we intruded, impinged when we imposed too heavy taxes. And he believed in budgets because he didn't want the government to have too much power, and also because he was concerned about the currency. At that time, we were not the established currency of reserve we are today. So all this is going on, and he believed in both, and he liked to make that graphic. So someone gave him twin lion cubs. They came from South Africa. People give presidents presents, right? Yep. They give them pets. What do you do with that? He named them, he didn't name them Barney. He didn't name them socks. He named them Budget Bureau and Tax Reduction. Two lions. And he fed them Even Steven. You can imagine, sliding the steak over because they had to be the same weight. That was the point, right? Budget Bureau and Tax Reduction. That's a man who's on message.
Oh, he's on message, all right. How did Americans receive this message at the time? How did he do in the 24 election, Amity?
Oh, he beat the other two parties. Remember, the phrase lame duck was first used for Coolidge because he came into the presidency at the death of Harding, and he was kind of skinny and kind of not quite tall enough for a president, kind of quiet. And people thought, well, in 24, someone else will be the man. There was even talk before Harding died of replacing Coolidge as vice president. He was Silent Cal. Yet, Coolidge's style was liked by the American people. And in 24, there were three parties, the Progressive Party of La Follette, the Democratic Party, and the Republican Party. Usually when that happens, you get a plurality, but not a majority.
Yep.
Coolidge took an absolute majority of the American vote. That is more than the Democrats and the Progressives combined, even though the Progressives, in number of votes, did rather well. They got 17% of the vote.
And we talked earlier about the misconceptions around Coolidge, the 1920s, and of course the Great Depression. As we wrap up this first of our multi-part series on your two books, The Forgotten Man and Coolidge and the Great Depression, tell us about what caused this depression. We'll dive deeper into the next part of our conversation on public sentiment about this and the narrative as written by certain segments of the historical population. But what do you think were the causes of the Great Depression?
Well, one should separate the Great Crash of 29 from the Great Depression. There were plenty of crashes in America that weren't followed by any old 10-year depression. That's important to know, for example, in 2021. So the crash, the stock market was too high. It was at 381. When it had been about 100 before. Every fool knows that, maybe a little bit high. It grew faster than the economy. Oh, it was too high. The Great Depression that followed, there were international factors, monetary factors, there were trade factors. But what made the Depression great, what made it abide from 35 to, say, 39, instead of be all recovered, was government intervention, was the policy of another president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
And there you have it, and you haven't heard this in school. What made the Depression great was the government intervention that you often hear saved us from the Great Depression. And you're hearing it from Amity Schlaes, and no one in this country, I think, knows more about this era and has written better about it. And we're going to continue this series on the 1920s and the Great Depression with Amity Schlaes. And this is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. And to hear this and all of our work, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. That's OurAmericanNetwork.org. This is Our American Stories, and every once in a while, we just bring you the best of some of our favorite shows and some of your favorites. And this one comes from For the Winds, Nate Scott. You hear from him every week from USA Today. And this was the very first story we did, the lost wallet story. This is a really funny story of a lost wallet told by Nate himself.
This is a story about one of my best friends, Riley Flaherty. Riley recently lost his wallet. It's a bummer, but it happens. He was at a Wilco concert at King's Theater in Brooklyn, and after the show, he took an Uber back home to Manhattan. As soon as he got home, he realized he didn't have his wallet. Riley had a trip the next morning. He really wanted the thing. So he had the driver take him all the way back. He searched the theater, but nothing. Now it's 3 in the morning, and Riley, dejected, heads back to Manhattan. He has some cash lying around, so he's able to go on the trip. But his wallet's gone. And so he does what you do when you lose a wallet. He cancels his credit cards. He actually was waiting on a new driver's license, so he got one of those, and he bought a new wallet. End of story. Or so you'd think. Because after that, a miracle happened. Well, a sort of miracle. A very New York miracle. 2 weeks after he lost his wallet, Riley received a plain white envelope in the mail. His name was written in shaky handwriting on it, and inside was his license, his credit cards, and a note. The note read, "Dear Riley Flaherty, I found your wallet, and your driver's license had your address, so here's your credit cards and other important stuff. I kept the cash because I needed weed, the Metro card because, well, the fare's $2.75 now, and the wallet because it's kind of cool. Enjoy the rest of your day. Toodles. Anonymous." I've never been so conflicted about a nice gesture, Riley told me. The cash, gone. The wallet, gone. The Metro card, gone. But 2 weeks later, returned in a plain white envelope, a driver's license, and his credit cards. I had already gone to get a new license, and had already gotten all my cards replaced, said Riley. So basically, it was useless to me. He did have this story, though, and no one can take that away from him.
No, you can't. And of course, we always get asked for the shower thoughts, and this is Jesse channeling his Stephen Wright. And so now we bring you one of your favorites.
Shower thoughts.
People shouldn't be allowed to use the bathroom on an airplane for flights lasting under 2 hours. If you can't hold it for that long, too bad. I'm sorry your mommy didn't teach you any self-control. I'd like to think that money wouldn't change who I am, but when I'm winning Monopoly, I become a terrible person. If organized crime started printing high-quality counterfeit college textbooks and then sold them at cut-rate prices, it'd be a really good public relations move. If pigs could fly, I bet their wings would taste delicious. When boarding an airplane, first-class passengers are forced to sit at eye level with the coach passengers' crotches as they board. Airlines could solve this problem by letting first class board last. Sometimes pets are better than children. They eat less, they don't ask for money, and if they get pregnant, you can just sell their babies. Dog food could say it's any flavor it wants to. You're not going to test it. When I was a small kid, my grandma used to show me love by playing along with my make-believe games. Now that she's older and has dementia, it's my turn to show love by playing along with hers. If you accuse someone of being argumentative, they can't disagree with you without proving your point. Why would anybody buy a bookmark for a dollar when they could use a dollar for a bookmark? According to most ghost photos, our clothes must have a soul too, otherwise all ghosts would be photographed naked. The kind of people who close the shade on an airplane window should be placed on the terrorist watch list and not be allowed to fly. These people are the last kind of soul-sucking vampires I would want to die with if, God forbid, the plane went down in flames over the sun-scorched desert. Shouldn't billboards be illegal since they distract you from the road? If you wash the dirt from a fallen ice cube, you're washing your water with water and hope that there's only water on the water that you will add to your water.
Shower thoughts.
Thanks for that, Jesse. Mm-hmm. And we love taking you down the road with certain artists, and we feature them for a half hour, an hour. And we did an hour on Martin Scorsese and got into that lapsed Catholic guilt he talked about often in that hour. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and look up Martin Scorsese in our This Day in History. And by the way, we looked up this guy's films. You name the letter in the alphabet. A, Age of Innocence. C, Casino. Color of Money, Cape Fear. D, The Departed. G, Goodfellas, Gangs in New York. K, King of Comedy. R, Raging Bull. T, Taxi Driver. W, Wolf of Wall Street. It's crazy. Well, here he is at the Kennedy Center talking about film, because so many people think film and the arts are silly. Scorsese had a different point of view.
Whenever I hear people dismiss movies as fantasy, I make a hard distinction between film and life. I think to myself that it's just a way of avoiding the power of cinema. I mean, of course it's not life. It's the invocation of life. It's an ongoing dialogue with life. Frank Capra said, film is a disease. He went on, but that's enough for now. I caught the disease early on, you know. I used to feel it. They used to take me to the movies all the time. I used to feel it whenever we walked up to the ticket booth, my mother and my father and my brother. You go through the doors and the thick carpet to the past the popcorn stand where it had that wonderful smell, then to the ticket taker. And then sometimes they get these doors would open in the back, and there were little windows in it in some of these old theaters, and I could see something magical happening up there on the screen, something special. And as we entered, for me, I think now it was like entering a sacred space, kind of a sanctuary where the living world around me seemed to be recreated and played out.
Storytelling isn't life, it's the invocation of life. That's what we try to do here on Our American Stories. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and we love music, and we spend at least 10 to 15% of our time on music. And the Wall Street Journal has a remarkable piece every Friday in their personal journal called Playlist. And one particular playlist was written by historian Elizabeth Fenn, a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. And Playlist is all about a song and how it impacted a person. And the person then writes about this song and how it affected their life. Elizabeth Fenn recorded her piece for us.
I first heard These Are Days by 10,000 Maniacs during a walkabout period in my life. In the mid-1980s, I dropped out of grad school at Yale and spent 8 years working as an auto mechanic at several North Carolina garages. Back then, I needed a new challenge and wanted to be with my partner, who became my husband. He taught at Duke University, where I had studied as an undergraduate. I've always liked metal and machines and decided to attend a community college nearby to learn how to fix cars. After a year, I took a job at a garage attached to a dealership. I loved mixing it up with the guys and having knockdown arguments about life. At the garage, my fellow mechanics argued constantly about country and rock radio stations and which ones to listen to. I had no opinion since I enjoyed both. One day in 1992, These Are Days came on the rock station. The song with Natalie Merchant singing had just been released and captured my existence. Days in the shop were hard, working in 100-degree heat, smashing my knuckles and breaking bolts. The song by Robert Buck and Ms. Merchant reminded me to appreciate what was going on around me. These are days you'll remember, never before and never since, I promise, will the whole world be warm as this. Never. Lyrics simultaneously expressed a realness and sense of loss, urging me to savor the present. The great thing about fixing cars is that you can go home at night, drink beer, and read. Around 1994, I read The Horseman on the Roof by Jean Giono. It's a 1951 novel set during the European cholera pandemic of 1832. The book inspired me to re-enroll at Yale, where I finished my history degree and wrote my first book, Pax Americana, the great smallpox epidemic of 1775 to 82. Today I teach at the University of Colorado Boulder and often bike 17 miles to campus. These Are Days is still on my iPod, but when it pops on, I'm not transported back to the garage. Instead, I'm reminded to look around at the mountains and experience the moment.
And we thank Elizabeth Fenn for that great reading. We also took a little trip down a Billy Joel lane. We spent a half hour on his life. And the guy sold 150 million records. He sold out Madison Square Garden more than anyone. Grew up in a small town in Long Island and dreamed of one day playing in the garden. His intellectual property, and that is the value of the artistic work. And by the way, that's preserved by the U.S. Constitution. Only in America is a song considered property. And the artists of this country benefit from that. And that could be worth a half $1 billion. Well, Billy Joel was performing a master class at the University of Pennsylvania. And we know the management of Joel's great team and the head manager, and we got permission to use this. And Joel was lecturing about the business of the music business, how to do it, how to write a song, how to sell the song, and then how to play, tour, and all the rest. In other words, how to monetize what you're doing, how to make it a business. And he said, of course, the word business is in the music business. Well, at the end, he was being asked questions by the audience, and there was one master piano and master Steinway grand on the stage, and a young lady got up and asked about a song, and she may have been 23 or 24, but she wanted to know about the song Lullaby. And, well, here's what Joel had to say about that song.
All right, so I had this melody. Which is how I write songs. I wrote the music first. She goes, "Daddy, what happens when you die?" So I said, "Oh, man. Whew. Okay." And I told her what I really believed. And what I really believe is, what happens when you die is you go into other people's hearts, that you never really go away. You go into the rest of the people that you knew. You go into the rest of their lives. They take them with you. So, but also this was during a time when her mom and I were splitting up. So this was like a double-pronged thing, like, "Daddy, are you going to leave me?" And I said, "I'll never leave you. I will never leave you. I'll never go away. I will never, never, ever leave you."
And you could see Joel choking up because this wasn't Madison Square Garden. It was an intimate venue and there was no band. And so he takes a breath. And then here's the answer to his little girl's question. Here's the first verse and chorus of Lullaby.
Good night, my angel. Time to close your eyes and save these questions for another day. I think I know what you've been asking me. I think you know what I've been trying to say. I promised I would never leave you, and you should always know. Wherever you may go, no matter where you are, I never will be far away.
And Joel, well, he starts to tear up and he just has a little bit of a breakdown because it's so personal to him. It's bringing him back. Yeah, I have seen him play many times. I never saw him explain the song before. Daddy, what happens when I die? And Daddy, are you going to leave me? Well, after tearing up, drying it off, he comes back, plays the second verse, and then closes things out with this final and stunning verse, tying the whole song and the loop together for his baby girl.
Good night, my angel, now it's time to dream. And dream how wonderful your life will be. Someday your child may cry, and if you sing this lullaby, then in your heart there will always be a part of me. Someday we'll all be gone, but lullabies go on and on. They never die, that's how you and I will be.
And if you've ever had a little girl and sung her a lullaby, you're tearing up now or you don't have a heart. And Joel went on to talk about how he wrote Piano Man. He went on to talk about the record business and the state of the business, agents, managers. And in the end, he talked about risk-taking. And he talked about failure and rejection. And just as Robert De Niro, who you're about to hear from later in his commencement speech at NYU, was telling that audience, don't take it personally. Rejection is a part of the business. And in fact, dare to fail. And by the way, isn't that what every entrepreneur in America says? Talk to them about their biggest failures. They'll tell you those were the times they learned the most. And there you have it. This is Our American Stories. We love music. We've done, wow, Robert Plant, an hour. Kurt Cobain's will kill you. And Duane Allman's is my favorite. And we go out with one of our favorite Billy Joel songs. What a story. About fishing on Long Island, the Downeaster Alexa. More after these messages. We'll be right back.
reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty, except for one man still driving and striving as fast as he can. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up. And long ago somebody left with the cup. But he's driving and striving and hugging the turns and thinking of someone for whom he still burns. He's going the distance.
This is Our American Stories, and we want to go into our American Dreamers segment, brought to us, as always, by the folks at Job Creators Network. And they're out there working hard for small business owners across this country, the driving force of the American economy. And we wanted to start with a guy who you wouldn't think is a small business owner, and he was. His name is Mario Andretti. And let's just say this about him, because I think there's only one stat I need to read, and that is he was named the driver of the century by both the American Motor Association and AP. Not a bad title. I don't think I need to read anything else. We caught up with Mario because his story is remarkable. He came from Italy when Italy lost in the war before it won. Well, they had some problems negotiating after 1945, and Yugoslavia took over a part of Italy that his father owned a family vineyard in for centuries. It had been in the family for centuries. And he couldn't say yes to Tito. So he gave up the vineyard. The family lived in a displaced person's home for 7 years, comes to America, but Mario Andretti reaches the heights of auto racing. And here's what he had to say about being born in America.
I feel that I'm a true, true example of the American dream. I don't see how anything could have happened to me unless we came to the States. Even under the environment that my dad had me under, you know, because of his this farming and so, I didn't want to do that. I had no, even as a youngster, I just despised that type of thing. You know, that's not what, set the fire in me. And, we loved my Uncle Bruno, you know, who was, you know, my mother's brother, you know, who was, he was an aviator in the aviation. He was he had motorcycles. He had, you know, he was that type of a guy, you know. And so there was something that, if we would have remained there, I probably would have become a plumber or something.
Yeah. Now, we love asking folks just a few questions, Mario, just personal ones. Your biggest regret, that is, the decision you made that you wish you could have pulled back in your life?
Well, I'm not sure that I have any regrets, quite honestly. You could always do something better, you know, by looking at it now. Okay, I might have made a better decision a different time. I'll give you an example. You know, when at the end of, my Formula One career with Lotus, I had a couple of opportunities, one to go either with McLaren or Alfa Romeo. And I went with my heart. You know, I went with Alfa Romeo because, you know, I had a friend, engineer there and so forth. And I thought Alfa Romeo was ready to spring, you know, into the top, in Formula One. And instead I could have gone with McLaren. I could have probably won another world championship with McLaren. So, you know, those are some things you call it a mistake, call it miscalculation. Yeah, you could, you know, now that I have a chance to revisit. But overall, Lee, I have no regrets. I have no regrets whatsoever. You know, the positive way, way overcome the negatives. And so, no regrets.
That's great. What gives you, Mario, at this stage of your life, your deepest sense of fulfillment?
The deepest sense of fulfillment is to be able to, with everything that's going on in my career and the distractions, and everything, to have been able to keep the family together throughout.
Yeah, and faith, does that play a role in your life, Mario? I mean, we know you're Catholic, but talk about that part of your life.
Faith does. Not just the fact that we had a priest in our family that was clergy, That was never anything that was really pushed on us. As a matter of fact, my Uncle Priest, I love that man more than anyone. He was such a modern thinker and everything even then. It was just that there was another chaplain in our camp, Lorenzo Tambellini, who somehow without forcing things, he instilled certain values, you know, that you maintain and keep, and always knowing that you can't do things alone. You know, you need some help, whether it's an abstract from upstairs or something. You know, you have to invoke something, believe in something, and I do. And many times I said, you know, I need some help here, please, you know, and somehow it works for you. It always did, and always will.
And last but not least, Mario, tell us about a hobby, a pastime, a secret passion that the audience might not expect Mario Andretti to have.
Well, hobbies, I mean, that's what we do. I just love recreation, and as you can imagine, I'm fortunate that we have a place up in the Poconos here. I have a lake, and I have every toy imaginable, you know, ATVs, I have boats, I have ultralight, we play tennis, we water ski. I just love all the things that, you know, they're energetic. And you ought to come up there. I'll get you tired really fast.
And I'm not going because he'll wear me out. The man, the boy, still the same, the love for speed. He couldn't wait to get off that farm. We heard the same story from Henry Ford. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and listen to that hour. It is special. We also did an hour on Levi Strauss. And we did that thanks to Out Where the West Begins, by Phil Anschutz and several other folks involved with the Strauss Company, the Levi Strauss Company. Let's take a listen to an excerpt of that hour.
It is here in Manhattan where jeans boutiques are lined up one after the other. Loeb Strauss began his unstoppable rise to become one of the greatest American industrialists. On January 24th, 1848, gold is discovered in Northern California.
One of us needs to take a first-hand look at the market out there.
Phil Anschutz writes in Out Where the West Begins that Strauss planned to get rich by exploiting market forces instead of prospecting for gold. During the gold rush era, he writes, there were more prospectors than there were tents, shovels, pickaxes, buckets, and pans. The state of California was completely settled within 3 years.
Well, then what are we waiting for?
For you to go to California.
But before Loeb Strauss went west, he became an American citizen. He swore an oath to the American Constitution and renounced the Bavarian king forever. At about the same time, he started going by the name of Levi Strauss. Here again is Hesia Diner.
So for this young man to come and want to be able to communicate with his customers, to say I'm Loeb Strauss may have been more difficult than to say I'm Levi Strauss. I'm not sure I'd want to say that this was a step towards assimilation, because he's keeping his Hebrew name, but it's a way of adaptation to the American circumstance.
Levi Strauss took a steamship from New York City through Panama and at 24 years of age opened for business as a wholesale trader to the San Francisco gold miners in 1853.
It's a remarkable story. Again, go to Our American Story. Go to This Day in OurAmericanNetwork.org. Go to This Day in History. Pull it down. I think we got about 75 segments. Levi Strauss is right about in the middle. And when we come back, more stories, including the story that Robert De Niro told the graduates at NYU last year about how to make it in almost any line of work. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories. And this past May, we ran through commencement speeches almost every night. Old ones, sort of new ones, mostly great ones. And by the way, one really terrible one, which was so terrible.
It was awesome.
It was funny. It was so terrible. And so you can go on OurAmericanNetwork.org and just get into the, go back about a month and a half and just scroll down. I mean, the commencement speeches are a who's who of America. And Denzel Washington's was spectacular, spectacular. And he emphasized things like hard work, faith, and family. And my goodness, faith was at the dead center of his speech. It was beautiful. Steve Jobs, really legendary speech at Stanford. We have that. And Admiral McCraven's at the University of Texas. Peter Pace's, General Peter Pace. My goodness, that one at Citadel was just terrific. And what we're going to play you now is a short clip from Robert De Niro's commencement speech at the Tisch School of Arts at NYU last year.
On this day of triumphantly graduating, a new door is opening for you. A door to a lifetime of rejection. It's inevitable. It's what graduates call the real world. You'll experience it auditioning for a part or a place in a company. It'll happen to you when you're looking for backers for a project. You'll feel it when doors close on you while you're trying to get attention for something you've written and when you're looking for a directing or a choreography job. How do you cope with it? I hear that Valium and Vicodin work. I don't know. You can't be too relaxed and do what we do. And you don't want to block the pain too much. Without the pain, what will we talk about? Rejection might sting, but my feeling is that often it has very little to do with you. When you're auditioning or pitching, the director or producer or investor may just have something or someone different in mind. That's just how it is. That happened to me recently when I auditioned for the role of Martin Luther King in Selma. Which was too bad because I could have played the hell out of that part. I felt it was written for me. But the director had something different in mind. And you know, she was right. It seems the director is always right.
And he went on to just talk about that none of it is personal. The rejection isn't personal. Don't take it personal. There just might have been someone better for that role. And don't take it personally and don't get angry and don't cry, because that same director might be auditioning your butt 8 years from now, and he'll remember you for your whining nature. So just buck up. Go to the next one. Next. He hit that word over and over again. Next. Next. Next audition. Next up, this is a letter that went positively viral on the web. It was a letter entitled, "To My Daughter with Down Syndrome on Her Wedding Day." The father, Paul Doherty, shares that super viral letter to his daughter for us.
"Dear Jillian, it is the afternoon of your wedding, June 27th, 2015. In 2 hours, you will take the walk of a lifetime, a stroll made more memorable by what you've achieved to get to this day. I don't know what the odds are of a woman with Down syndrome marrying the love of her life. I only know you've beaten them. You are upstairs now, making final preparations with your mom and bridesmaids. Your hair is coiled perfectly above your slender neck. Your bejeweled dress, my bling, you called it, attracts every glimmer of late afternoon sunshine pouring through the window. Your makeup, that red lipstick, somehow improves upon a beauty that has grown since the day you were born. Your smile is blooming and everlasting. I'm outside, beneath that window, staring up. We live for moments such as these, Jillian, when hopes and dreams intersect at a sweet spot in time, when everything we've always imagined arrives and assumes a perfect clarity. Bliss is possible. I know that now, standing beneath that window. I have everything and nothing to tell you. When you were born and for years afterward, I didn't worry for what you'd achieve academically. Your mom and I would make that happen. We'd wield the law like a cudgel if we had to. We could make teachers teach you, and we knew you'd earn the respect of your peers. What we couldn't do was make other kids like you, accept you, befriend you, stand with you in the vital social arena. We thought, what's a kid's life like if it isn't filled with sleepovers and birthday parties and dates to the prom? I worried about you then. I cried deep inside on the night when you were 12 and you came downstairs to declare, I don't have any friends. We all wish the same things for our children. Health, happiness, and a keen ability to engage and enjoy the world are not only the province of typical kids, their pursuit is every child's birthright. I worried about your pursuit, Jillian. I shouldn't have. You're a natural when it comes to socializing. They called you the mayor in elementary school for your ability to engage everyone. You danced on the junior varsity dance team in high school. You spent 4 years attending college classes and made lifelong impressions on everyone you met. Do you remember all the stuff they said you'd never do, Jills? You wouldn't ride a two-wheeler. You wouldn't play sports. You wouldn't go to college. You certainly wouldn't get married. Now, look at you. You're the nicest person I know, someone who is able to live a life of empathy and sympathy, and without agendas or guile, is someone we all want to know. It worked out for you because of the person you are. I would tell you to give your fiancé, Ryan, your whole heart, but that would be stating the obvious. I would tell you to be kind to him and gentle with him, but you do that already, with everyone you know. I would wish for you a lifetime of friendship and mutual respect, but you two have been together a decade already, so the respect and friendship already are apparent. A decade ago, when a young man walked to our door wearing a suit and bearing a corsage made of cymbidium orchids, said, I'm here to take your daughter to the homecoming, sir. Every fear I have ever had about your life being incomplete vanished. Now you and Ryan are taking a different walk together. It's a new challenge, but it's no more daunting for you than for anyone else. Given who you are, it might be less so. Happiness comes easily to you, as does your ability to make happiness for others. I see you now. The prep work has been done. The door swings open. My little girl, all in white, crossing the threshold of yet another conquered dream. I stand breathless and transfixed, utterly in the moment. You look beautiful, is the best I can do. Jillian thanks me. I'll always be your little girl, is what she says then. Yes, you will, I manage. Time to go, I say. We have a walk to make.
And indeed, he made that walk, and Stan just showed me a picture of the beautiful bride and her dad. And what a story to my daughter with Down syndrome on her wedding day. And again, that's Paul Daugherty and his beautiful girl, his baby girl, Jillian. And again, to hear this story, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and share it with friends. Please do. And last but not least, our intrepid field reporter and producer, Alex Cortez. Well, he wanted to run down a story because he had heard that in Wisconsin, it was illegal for low prices to be too low. Let's take a listen.
In America, we're used to hearing strange news reports like this one.
Linda Carson, ABC 7, would you not eat my pants? Ah!
Or this one.
Curiosity leads to large crowds in Mobile's Crichton community. Many of you bring binoculars, camcorders, even camera phones to take pictures.
To me, it looked like a leprechaun to me. I got to look up in the tree. Who else seen the leprechaun? Say yeah! Yeah!
Eyewitnesses say the leprechaun only comes out at night. If you shine a light in its direction, it suddenly disappears.
But perhaps stranger than them all is one that Wisconsinites saw on their televisions the other day.
Low prices are part of the Meijer business model, but are they too low? The company says it's never encountered this type of situation in any other state where it operates.
You did hear that right. They said too low. Here's how a rival TV station put it.
But now the regional chain faces an unusual problem, accused of breaking Wisconsin law by offering deals that are too good.
Deals that are too good? So good that they might be illegal? When we heard this, our brains and our wallets were so unsettled that we had to find out what on earth is going on here and whether we were still even on the planet Earth. And so we asked an expert, the president of a think tank called the McIver Institute. And more importantly, Brett Healy is a Wisconsin resident and expert shopper. Brett said the law came from dead people.
Well, Wisconsin's minimum markup law is a relic from the distant past. It was originally passed back in 1939, and essentially the law makes it illegal for retailers and wholesalers to sell merchandise at a discount.
Something that Meijer says it has never encountered before.
Meijer's spokesman says this is a bit peculiar for us. We're not accustomed to regulations that limit our customers' ability to save money when they shop with us.
And that may be one of the strangest stories we've done here on Our American Stories. Great work always by the whole team here. And if you want to see or hear any of our material, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org.